You're listening to the Talking Rheumatology Podcast, brought to you by the British Society for Rheumatology.
Hello and welcome to Talking Rheumatology. I'm Caroline Groves, Journal Development Officer at BSR, and I'm delighted to be hosting this short series where I interview the winners of the BSR Best Practice Awards 2022. In today's episode, I'm talking to Dr. Toby Garood, who is representing the team from Guy's Hospital of Guy's and St. Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust. Toby's winning project is entitled Digital Health in Rheumatology and is comprised of three parts: a telephone appointment booking system, a digital pre-appointment questionnaire for patients, and a remote monitoring platform. So, Toby, welcome to the podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Toby Garood. I'm a rheumatology consultant at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospitals in London.
So, I mean, firstly, congratulations on the award. But can we start by summarising your project? How did it come about?
So these projects, there were three projects we submitted for this, and it was born out of taking a design-based approach to healthcare. So over the last few years, we've done a lot of work trying to understand the unmet needs in our pathways and patient experience. So these were some of the products of those processes, and there were three projects, one of which was just trying to simplify access to our helpline. So none of these projects is complicated. So the first one was to do with trying to make sure that patients could access reliable advice at a time which worked for them. And previously we'd been relying on a answering machine. But the problem with that is you leave a message on an answering machine, you've got no idea when you're going to get called back. And so a lot of our patients were missing the return call. So 20 to 25% or so were never getting the call back, and this caused frustration for patients and anxiety, and wasn't a great use of time for our nursing team. And also, if patients can't get advice from us, they need to get it from somewhere else. So they would sometimes pop up elsewhere in the system, either with their GP or, worst case scenario, in the emergency department. So what we did was we put a interface on our website whereby patients could go in, choose a time and date to get phoned back. They put in their mobile number, their name and their problem, and we'd call them back at that time. So it wasn't rocket science. But it solved the problem. So now we have, with this particular system, we have less than 4% non-completion rate. And with the other portfolio of access channels we have, which includes email, SMS, and our remote monitoring platform, which we'll come on to, about 99% of our patients get some sort of advice or signposting within 24 hours of contacting us. So it was a very, very simple solution to a difficult problem. The next one was trying to solve two problems. One is, how can we better direct patients who are newly referred to us to the right pathway first time, and also how can we get a better quality of information in referrals? And the problem of not having the right referral information has been around for a long time. It's not new. It's not because our referrers aren't trying to write good referral letters, because they don't always know what we need to know to make the right decision. So we're thinking about this, and the solutions that are usually proposed are either that you just need to provide better education for referrers and GPs, or you design a form for people to fill in. People don't really like forms, so they don't always work very effectively. So the idea was, well, why don't we pull the patient into the referral process, because patients can just as easily tell you about the problem as the GP can. So rather than go back to the GP saying, sorry, not enough information, and then go back to the patient and come back to you, we just go straight to the patient. So now at the point of referral, patients are asked to complete some information and submit it to us, which we then can use alongside the GP referral letter. And there's two bits to the form. One is looking at more generic determinants of health, which include mental health, smoking, and alcohol risk. And the other part is more specific measures around their disease. So what's the distribution of pain? Do they have somatic symptoms and so forth? So the two outputs have been, one, that we now have visibility of some of the key determinants of health patients have. So what we've learned from this is that of the patients referred to us, 33% scored moderately or higher for risk of depression on the PHQ-8, and 22% were scoring moderate risk for anxiety, which is quite significant, and that's higher than you see in the background population, even though these patients may not necessarily have a long-term rheumatic disease. We also found that around 20% of patients were scoring significantly for alcohol risk, which is unexpected, and about 15% were smokers, half of whom wanted help giving up. And this is important because, A, all these things impact on outcomes and diseases we deal with, but also these are really important background population health problems anyway, and they're significant in our communities. They are overrepresented in the more deprived segments of our communities, and i.e. in the people who are least likely to access healthcare. So as well as being important to the disease we may be treating, it's just important for its own sake. And because in the current climate, patients may have or do have less access to healthcare than they did pre-COVID. If we've got a patient sitting in front of us who has depression or who is smoking or drinking too much, then I think we have an obligation to address that regardless of what else may be going on. So it's the idea is around trying to make every contact count and just use the opportunity of contact with healthcare to do something more holistic with them. But the other side of it was looking at the distribution of pain and various other factors. So for instance, the forms include the diagnostic criteria for fibromyalgia. And we found that if you look at the data in its raw form, and you compare that with the final diagnosis of the patient, the accuracy for diagnosing fibromyalgia is about 73%, I think it was, which is okay. But we found that now by putting this through machine learning algorithms, we can actually start to produce a better predictive accuracy. So we think we're now in a position, we'll be within the next 6 months when our data scientists finish working, that we can start to actually use this to stratify patients into pathways. So for instance, a patient at high risk of having a non-inflammatory pain syndrome could be directed to a physiotherapist first time. So we think that downstream this will free up capacity for us to direct patients who need more urgent attention to consultants. And the third project was around remote monitoring. So this is around collecting PROM data from patients who are not sitting in front of us. And there are two reasons for doing that. One is when they do come and see you, if you're collecting regular patient-reported outcome measures, you've got a good story about how that patient has been over the ensuing time when you haven't seen them, and you can break that down into subcomponents. So, for instance, we use the RAID for rheumatoid arthritis. So a patient, we haven't seen a patient for 12 months, and they've been using the platform, they'll come in, we'll have a monthly measure of overall RAID score, and that can be broken down by subcomponents such as fatigue, pain, or quality of sleep, or emotional distress. So it's really useful to do that. We think it'll better inform treatment decisions, but also it informs the conversation itself, so you can have a more detailed conversation with the patient about how they've been. But for a subset of patients on the platform, we can choose to actively monitor them. So the system will flag up somebody whose score has gone out of range to our administrator, or then flag that up either to us or send them some self-help information. So the idea is by through actively monitoring some of our patients, we should be able to keep them away from hospital for longer. So this is patients affected in remission or low disease activity, but also make sure we see them when they need to be seen. We should make better use of our capacity. And again, we think that the longer term impact will be that we free up a significant amount of outpatient capacity to do that. But an important thing for us was around the design of this, because over the years, there's been a lot of iterations of remote monitoring or PROM collection platforms for patients, but they don't always catch on. And so we did a lot of work with patients trying to understand what they want from us or from a platform just to collect data. And what we found was rather than wanting something very complicated in the form of an app, what they wanted was really three things. One was simplicity. So it had to be very, very simple to use. The other was accessibility. We find that SMS is a better means of delivery of requests than email, for instance. The patients didn't really want apps, or not as much, they wanted SMS. But the third thing, and perhaps most important, is they wanted it to feel human. So they wanted somebody at the other end of it who they knew was looking at the data they were submitting. So putting in that feedback loop from a human being makes patients feel engaged. And we've recently completed some evaluation work which shows that patients do feel looked after by the platform. The impact of that has been that they use it. So about 80% of our patients will complete it every month, and that's sustained over time, so they don't fall off over time. And we're now looking at the longer term impact of that, whether his is meeting our hypothesis that we can release follow-up capacity from patients who remain well.
Now, I mean, the patient involvement in this project is really impressive, and it led to patient personas being developed, which I think is an interesting concept. Can you tell us a bit more about those?
So I wouldn't claim to be an expert in this, but we did work with a design agency, and there's two things to that. One is the idea of really understanding patient experience. So what we tend to do in healthcare is we will get patients filling questionnaires or tend to focus group perhaps, but I don't think that really gets the root unmet needs in our population. So you can ask a patient who's been to your service, how did you do? But you can't ask a patient that hasn't been to your service, who couldn't get into your service, how did you do? And it's difficult to ask patients, what should we have done that we didn't? So I think it has limitations. And it's only by really understanding how healthcare fits into the lives of patients and what is it they really need from healthcare, and how do they manage their condition when they're not sitting in front of you, and what are the inconveniences and barriers that we throw up, that you can really start to understand how to better design pathways. And personas are a way of just characterising subgroups of patients. So, for instance, you may have the highly engaged, motivated patient. You may have somebody who's unmotivated or struggling. You may have somebody who struggles to get to the hospital or struggles to use digital tools. And by taking each of those personas and just putting them through a pathway and thinking, well, what would happen to this person at this stage of that pathway, and then validating that with real patients, it gives you a better overview and understanding of exactly what it is you need to get right and what is it you're not doing that will help you produce better service design.
And so the project used a minimum viable product approach. So can you tell us what this is and why it was beneficial?
So the minimum viable product approach is born out of software design, I think, originally. And the idea is that rather than producing something full of bells and whistles and over-engineered and exactly as you want it to be in its perfect form, and then releasing that on an unsuspecting public, only to find they don't like it, what the minimum viable product approach does, it means it, the idea is you take something and you break it down into its simplest component. So, for instance, if you're building an app or a questionnaire for a patient, the minimum viable product is a bit of paper with a form just sketched out. You put it in front of the patients and say, what do you think of that? And if they are willing to fill it in and you think that it adds value, then you can then go and prototype that. Something called a non-functioning prototype. So you can just build something that looks like a form on a phone and say, well, what do you think of that? And if they like that, then you can build it. So it means you can just release very simple measures that will help you learn very, very quickly whether the idea has got legs, rather than investing huge amounts of time and money in something which you find, discover the patients don't want. But the other advantage of it is if you're looking at a pathway, you can break it down into its components and decide what are the really high-risk assumptions there, such as patients will use an online questionnaire, for instance. So you can just get that online questionnaire up before you build anything around it, test it, see if patients fill it in. Because if they don't, then you learn your lesson, go and do something else. So it's quite a simple concept, but it doesn't mean that you can test ideas quickly and simply and cheaply without betting the farm on the outcomes.
So let's move on to the results of your project. I mean, I know you've mentioned your engagement levels, but maybe we could look at also cost savings, patient feedback.
So patient feedback for all of them has been very good, and we have solicited patient feedback from all three of the projects. An important thing for us is understanding why patients don't use them. So there are, as I said, the engagement rate is about 80% with the pre-appointment questionnaire with remote monitoring, but we're now doing some work to learn what are the predictors of non-engagement. So what are the predictors around ethnicity or deprivation or age or sex or whatever it may be, which predict non-engagement. That's really important for us to understand that so we can better tune the tools to patients. We did do a lot of work when we were looking at getting patients to fill forms in to figure out how do you get patients to fill them in the first place. So with the pre-appointment questionnaire, when we first released it, we were getting response rates of somewhere between 35 and 40%. But by tweaking the messaging, that made a difference. So if you say, please fill in this questionnaire, you'll get 35% of patients completing it. If you say, please fill in this questionnaire, and this is why you're filling it in, and this is the value it'll deliver to you in your life, that will get it up. If you use patient's first name in a text, that makes a difference. The time of day makes a difference. And the nature of reminder text as well. So through doing these recurrent iterations of that, we got it up to that 80%. So that was a really important part of understanding how to get patient engagement. The feedback has been good across all of them. As I said, we've got the response rates for requests for advice up to 96% plus. Of those patients who use that platform, about 80% of what we're calling chargeable, which means that these are calls that prevent patients using resources elsewhere in the system, such as general practice or whatever it may be. And so through negotiating with commissioners, we've agreed funding through that by demonstrating that 80% of our patients are chargeable calls. So that was the impact of that. Of the pre-appointment questionnaire, as I've already said, it does increase visibility of some of the key determinants of health which need to be addressed. And we're just within 6 months position, we can start stratifying patients into specific pathways. So we think that will deliver release of capacity. We think we can release at least 500 new patient appointments a year if we stratify patients with non-inflammatory syndromes into the right pathway, but that will really be tested. The remote monitoring platform, as I said, patient feedback has been really good. We just completed a detailed evaluation exercise with King's Improvement Science, which we're hoping to publish within the next 6 months or so. Response rates have been high and sustained. The impact is whether we are able to release capacity, and that's been difficult to test during the pandemic because we've already got backlogs. Patients aren't being seen as regularly as they would be otherwise being anyway. So now things are settling down. Over the next 6 to 12 months, we'll be assessing the impact of the hypothesis that we can keep patients who are well away from hospital.
So, I mean, I think it's clear that these projects have been extremely successful. But if you were to offer some advice to other teams who were looking to implement similar interventions, what would that advice be?
Well, none of these interventions are complicated, and we wouldn't claim any of this is rocket science. I think it's important to share with the rheumatology community what works, what doesn't, and share ideas. As I say, those are successful and those which fail. I think in the past we haven't been very good at that. We don't have tools which are necessarily very efficient at sharing good ideas, and often things which fail are buried through shame or for other reasons. So I think it's really important that we do learn to celebrate the failures as well as the successes. I think we've learned a lot around the design process. I think actually understanding the user experience is really important. The other big bit of learning for me was around how you learn to challenge assumptions. There are a lot of assumptions around how to deliver healthcare, such as patients can't be part of the referral process, for instance. But as soon as you actually think, well, actually, maybe that's not true, you can start to come up with things which you might not have come up with before. So I think challenging assumptions is important. Understanding patient experience is important. Making sure that you're addressing the right problems is really important as well. And having the capacity to be able to just test ideas quickly and cheaply is really important as well. But I think, as I said, I think then sharing what you've learnt and building what other people have learned is really, really critical to success.
And I know you've touched on it, but what's next for the projects and the team?
So for the pre-appointment questionnaire, we're doing some work with NHS Improvement Directorate, who have given some data science support. So we're hoping to refine an algorithm which will help us to stratify patients into the pathway to which they're most likely to be suited. So that's something which we hope will be complete within 6 months. We are looking at predictors of engagement with all of our questionnaires at the moment, and comparing that with some of the other systems which are out there, which some of our patients use. With remote monitoring, we are now pushing that to other sites in South East London. So we're hoping that our colleagues in South East London will come on board, which they've started to do, which will help us to learn right across a geographic area, how does this work for patients, what are the variations between different departments, and what do the outcomes look like across our patient populations. So I think through this we should be able to start to look at how we can harmonise pathways, and maybe in the future there will come a time where we can actually centrally monitor patients across a larger geographic region. We're also built in other problems into the platform, so we started with rheumatoid arthritis, we've now got spondyloarthritis, psoriatic arthritis, we've got the MSKHQ in there for patients who may not fit into any particular category, and we're also testing it in other areas such as gastroenterology, physiotherapy, so there's lots of ongoing work.
Well, you've got lots in the pipeline there. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Toby. I'd encourage our listeners to visit the BSR website, where you can find out more about the Best Practice Awards, and of course to listen to the other episodes in this series, where we explore further examples of best practice in rheumatology. Thanks again, Toby.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Talking Rheumatology, brought to you by BSR. Please do rate, share and subscribe through your favourite podcast app.